Good afternoon to all of you. My wife and daughter are at the coast with a couple of friends, so it's just me. They're having some R&R and hopefully able to watch online. So greetings to them. Greetings to all of you that are watching this today online and to all, obviously you that I'm sharing this space with. Happy Sabbath to you. Some months ago, for those of you that heard it, I gave a sermonette-length message about two heroes in the Bible, and I promised to come back to the subject because when I was putting it together, I realized that it was a much bigger subject than I had time for. And so I wanted to do it justice. And so for those of you that heard the original message, some of the content, some of it will be a review, but a lot of it won't be. I'm going to get into a lot more depth on the subject. So this will be an important message, part of my message that I couldn't leave out. By the way, the prime example that we're going to look at today is that there are parts of the Bible that we look at, we read them a certain way, and in many cases, the translators did not do it justice. And we're going to see that here. You have to take things in context to really get the true meaning of it. So we're going to dig deep in that. Most of the heroes in the Bible are men. But to start with, we're going to look at a couple of unlikely heroes in the Bible who were not men and were also more than likely not even Israelites, as we're going to see. So turn with me to Exodus 1, verse 15. Like I did before, we're going to take our time in the chapters from 15 on to the end of the verses, that is, from Exodus 1 and verse 15 to the end. Exodus 1, verse 15. We're going to read the first two, 15 and 16, these scriptures, and then we're going to parse it down a little bit. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah and the name of the other Puah, and he said, "When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on the birth stools. If it is a son, then you shall kill him. If it is a daughter, then she shall live." What is emphasized here is that Pharaoh gave a very direct, very clear order. And because it is highlighted here, it highlights the courage of those who did not follow this evil mandate that he gave. So first of all, I'm going to look at the term Hebrew midwives, as it is in my New King James Version. It's the Hebrew term, meyaldot ha-ivriyot, and it is itself an ambiguous term. And that's where the whole interpretation of this kind of goes sideways. When I say ambiguous, it can be interpreted two ways. The midwives of the Hebrews, or the midwives were Hebrews. And we're going to see here that it was actually the midwives of the Hebrews is the correct way to look at this. Obviously, the more likely situation, and there's many ways we come to that conclusion. So there's a few clear suggestions that these were not Hebrew women at all. First of all, if Pharaoh had actually wanted Hebrew babies killed, he would not ask Hebrew women to kill their own children and expect it to actually get done. Let's look deeper into verse 15. One of the issues that's made here is a clear moral point that these midwives their names are mentioned, Shiphrah and Puah. This is a moral point because even though the Pharaoh then and even since then, for as long as there were pharaohs, were basically considered to be a demigod. They were above men as far as how they were thought of in Egypt. And his name is not even mentioned here. And yet, the lower, as they would consider in society, lower than Pharaoh, their names are. These midwives are mentioned. And in fact, since this happened until today, the name Shiphrah is, modern spelling is Shifrah, is a very common name, well thought of in the Jewish faith. Still very popular. Verse 16. And he said, "When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, If he was talking to Hebrew women, he wouldn't say to the Hebrew women. So he's right up front here referring to them as third person. Now, as it goes on, and he says, and see them, again, third person. He's talking to the midwives, and he's saying, when you see them, third person, on the birth stool, you shall kill, if it's a son, you shall kill him. If it's a daughter, then she shall live. So, for now, we're going to go back to the main point of my message, and it's a thread that works through all of the examples that we're going to look at today. And that starts here in verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So we see right away that the Bible does not say that the midwives saved the babies because they could not bear to harm them, which would, may or may not be true. And it doesn't say that it was because they loved God. It doesn't say that either. It clearly says the reason is because they feared God. By the way, the title of my message is Fear God and Not the King, if you'd like to title my message. Continuing, verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. They did not do as the king of Egypt told them to do. They resisted this. It was a very evil mandate to the highest power of the land at the time. Now, it wasn't just Moses that they saved alive, but all the male children that they could, that was in their power to save, they didn't murder them like Pharaoh told them. Verse 18. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? So word got back to him. Here's another reason why we know these weren't Hebrews. He would never have asked Hebrew women why they didn't kill their own babies. This would have been a silly question for him to ask. The Pharaoh with this mandate was evil. It was an evil mandate. The Pharaoh, by issuing this evil mandate, was evil, but he was not stupid. Verse 19. And the midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Here we see one of the strongest arguments yet that these were not Hebrew women. Again, they're talking to Pharaoh, third person, because the Hebrew women, if they were Hebrew women, they wouldn't have said Hebrew women. They were talking about a third person, someone other than them. For are not like the Egyptian women, for they, again, third person, for they are, in my translation, lively. It's also translated vigorous. Give birth before the midwives come to them. What was their reason for not killing the babies? It's because they feared God. We just read that. Here they told a clear lie to Pharaoh, expecting him to believe it. This was not true. This was a complete and total fabricated lie to appease the Pharaoh. But it goes even deeper. Their actual reason was because they feared God, not because they gave birth too quickly. So they lied to Pharaoh. The words translated here, they are lively or they are vigorous, actually in Hebrew is ki chayot hayna, and it also means they are animals. Okay, so this is like the translation before, Hebrew midwives, also in a way misinterpreted. Rather than saying they are lively, it makes much more sense that Pharaoh would believe this, that they are animals. And in this instance, it makes a lot of sense. The midwives understood that Pharaoh, like most slave owners, had a racist view of the enslaved people. And he was therefore willing to believe that the Hebrews, because of his racist view, were like animals. He was readily convinced that unlike the refined Egyptian women, the Hebrew women, like animals, could give birth without requiring any assistance. This was easy for him to believe. Ironically, it was Pharaoh's own racism that enabled him to accept this as true, the lie that the midwives had told him. Again, it's another indication that the midwives were not Hebrew because, once again, in verse 19, they used the third person, they. Verse 20. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied. multiplied and grew very quickly. Now, it doesn't say mighty, it says very mighty. God dealt with the midwives, and they grew very mighty. Verse 21. And so it was because the midwives, what? The midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. Again, it doesn't say because they couldn't bear to kill babies or loved God. It said that they feared God. God rarely rewards people so immediately as he does here and directly. God's reward of the midwives shows how much he approved of their behavior. And you remember what inspired their behavior. They feared God. So why is it so important to understand that these were Egyptian women to the Hebrews, Egyptian midwives to the Hebrews, and not Hebrew midwives? There's a very important and powerful reason here to make that distinction, because it emphasizes the courage that they showed. These weren't Hebrew women standing up to another ruler. These were subjects of the Pharaoh that he had personal audience with, giving them an order, and it shows the courage even more. So these weren't slaves he was talking to. Why would he even bother himself talking to slaves if they were, as it said, Hebrew women? They were bold enough to stand up to an evil mandate, and yet they were also crafty enough to give a reason to the Pharaoh that he would accept and get him to back off of persecuting them for not killing innocent children. Verse 22. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who was born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So he charged or commanded, as my translation says, what he couldn't get the midwives to do, he now pushes all of his people to do, which is to murder innocent children. Now, the whole Egyptian people are implicated now in murder because of this. And we see their whole nation paying the price later on, don't we? Plagues, plundering when they left, right? The army destroyed. They paid a dear price for participating. The entire country that wasn't the midwives. Also, as cruel as Pharaoh is, he could not have committed this extermination of so many on his own. He couldn't have done it. The Bible reminds us that only through the cooperation of the masses that massive evil is committed. So we see the same thing happened to the Christ child, don't we, in Matthew 2. And ironically, they fled to Egypt to escape a murder mandate. For the sake of time, we're not going to read that story, but if you'd like to, it's in Matthew 2, verses 13 to 18. So staying in verse 22, just a little bit longer, how could Pharaoh have commanded all of his people to do this? I mean, most people would have trouble marching through the countryside fulfilling what someone had told them to do, such as hunting down the Hebrew boy babies. Think about it. Pharaoh was more than likely their landlord. He owned them and their property. Roughly 300 years before, when the Hebrews first came to the area, an ancestor of the Hebrews helped the Pharaoh at the time pull off one of the largest land grabs in all of history. Now, it's amazing what you can do when you know the future 14 years in advance. I mean, think of it. If you knew what companies were to 14 years stocks, you could make proper investments and you'd be very wealthy. Well, back then, this actually happened. By putting away the grain during the 7 good years, people would give anything during the 7 bad years to eat, including giving away their land, selling everything, all their possessions, just so that they could eat. People from the surrounding areas, we know they came down from Canaan because they also were experiencing the same drought. They came from all around, but especially the people there in Egypt. Joseph helped the Pharaoh at the time and the ones after him to be the richest, become rich beyond imagination. And it's no wonder that Joseph was second only to Pharaoh. He made him a very, very wealthy man. Getting back to the midwives. Shiphrah and Puah were revolutionaries in their time. Some of the first ones were those midwives to stand up to an evil mandate from the most powerful individual in their world. And the very child that was saved also went up against that same empire, and he challenged it in two ways. Let's look at what that child grew up to do. And I'm going to quote a man who, like his father before him, was an author and a historian. And as it happens, at the time of the interview, this man was the Prime Minister of Israel. As he talks about Moses, and we'll hear what he has to say. Quote, "Moses was the greatest revolutionary of all time. Remember that in antiquity, there were grand empires that were based on one principle, and that is slavery. Moses challenged that twice. He challenged it, one, by taking his people who were slaves in bondage in Egypt and freed them." Obviously, God did it, but I'm quoting here. "Took them to their promised land, but he also challenged it, too, by providing a code, a moral code that said it is not the king or the emperor that decides the law. There is a higher law. These were absolutely revolutionary ideas." End of quote. I'm going to repeat the main power line right here. It is not the king or the emperor that decides the law. There is a higher law. The prime minister I quoted was Benjamin Netanyahu. The midwives understood this. They understood that there was a higher law than the king. Just like the prime minister said about Moses, this was a revolutionary idea. The midwives that were commissioned to kill Moses understood that. So basically, we see two types of people here with the Pharaoh's mandates. We see in the Egyptians two groups: those that feared God, saved babies. Those who feared the Pharaoh killed babies. Fear of the king and his mandates led to death. All right? Fear of the king and his mandates led to death. So it's better for life to fear God than it is to fear the Pharaoh, the king, the president, the governor, the emperor, communist dictator. Go down the list. People in power do have, in many cases, evil mandates which are not to be followed. Now, Moses himself wrote about the oppression that is put on people through slavery and through the slavery system that he was born into. He actually was raised out of the slavery, but he understood it quite well. Leviticus 25, we see what Moses has to say about the oppression of that slavery system. Leviticus 25, we're going to look at verses 17 to 19. "Therefore," Leviticus 25:17, "you shall not oppress. You shall not oppress one another, but you shall" what? Fear God. Central thread here. "For I am the Lord your God, so you shall observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them, and you will dwell in the land and safely. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell there in safety." In other words, you're going to be blessed. We see this again in Deuteronomy 8. Let's go there in Deuteronomy 8, verse 6. Deuteronomy 8, 6. "Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to" what? Like Shifra and Pua, you are to fear him. This is followed by verses 7 to 10, showing the wonderful blessings that happened as a result of fearing God. We have examples of others who did not fear the king's edict, but they instead feared God, such as Daniel and his three friends. They were facing death mandate, but their fear of God was greater, and their life choices actually reflected that fear of God, and that they were making the right choice. And I'm not going to go through the entire story of them. You're all familiar with those events, but if you want to read about their defiance of the king and the king's mandate, those stories can be found in Daniel 3 and Daniel 6. Very wonderful stories to read every now and then. Another example of not heeding the king's mandate, of course, was Esther. She feared God more than the king. And like the midwives and Daniel and his friends, her life was on the line as well, as we know. So in a short bit, we're going to look at another hero in the Bible, another non-Hebrew, as it happens, like Shifra and Pua. She was a woman. And we're going to look at what made her a hero and how it ties together everything we've looked at so far. But first, we're going to look at some travelers and how they assess the areas that they were in at the time. Let's look at these travelers in Genesis 20 and how they looked at the land that they were traveling in. Genesis 20, verse 11. It's funny that the first speaker spoke about Abimelech and Gerar, and that's exactly what we see right here in Genesis 20, verse 11. Basically, from verse 1 all the way through to 10, it describes this, the events of King Abimelech. And in verse 11, Abraham said, "Because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife." So he's rating the country that he's in, that land, based on what? Whether he believes they have the fear of God or not. Okay. Surely the fear of God is not in this place. Now this was before Shiphrah and Puah, obviously, because it was, Moses was at the time of Shiphrah and Puah. And we see here the fear of God being mentioned, don't we? It's being mentioned, and it is in relation to the behavior of ruling powers, just like it was with Shiphrah and Puah in their dealing there with the Pharaoh. By the way, he gets his name mentioned here, Abimelech does, and not the Pharaoh of Shiphrah's time, because as the story unfolds, he was not an evil person like the original Pharaoh, so he does get his name mentioned. And for starters, Abraham had already been to Egypt, as we read in chapters previous, the same land that Shiphrah and Moses would eventually be born into, and he was comparing the people of Gerar to the people of Egypt, who he knew previously from the time that he was there had no fear of God. He had been there. They had no fear of God, and he was suspicious now, and he knew how people acted in his time, especially if those people had no fear of God. How people with no fear of God treated strangers and women, and apparently Sarah was an attractive enough woman to get the attention of two different kings. Now, by implication here in verse 11, by saying that surely the fear of God is not in this place, he's acknowledging that there can be good, God-fearing people outside of one's own religious group. Because he's rating it based on that. So it could go either way, but he was a suspicious person at this point. So we saw that with Shiphrah and Puah, they were outside of the Hebrew group, and yet they feared God. Now, for much of Western society, much of Western history, decent men and women have been referred to as God-fearing. This was a great compliment. But in our secular age, the term God-fearing is almost never used. Have you noticed that? On the contrary, it is almost always considered a foolish anachronism. Doesn't even apply anymore. No one uses it. But the concept itself is morally vital, as we'll see, as we have seen in the story of the midwives. It is a very vital concept. So in relation to the term God-fearing, I'm going to actually quote a very passionate atheist about God-fearing. And he is he's the godfather of the secular French Enlightenment. Following is a quote from Voltaire. "I want my lawyer, my tailor, my servants, and even my wife," this is an atheist, remember, "and even my wife to believe in God, because it means that I will be cheated and robbed less often." So a passionate atheist wanted all of those around him to be God-fearing people. So we can see that even passionate atheists would prefer to be around God-fearing, because even they know God-fearing people live by a moral code, and it leads to a society that is good to live in. So fearing God is a central tenet to living in a good society. Now, as I promised, we're going to look at another non-Hebrew hero. As it happens, this person, also like Shiphrah and Puah, was a woman. She was a non-Hebrew hero, and she also earned her role in the history of the universe, honestly, if you want to look at it that way, by her actions. And her actions, the actions of this non-Hebrew woman, were based on the fear of God. She also stood up to a king's mandate and valued life over the fear of a king. Let's look at her story. It's a remarkable woman. Low station in life, she made the right choices. Let's turn to Joshua 2. We're going to begin in verse 1, Joshua 2. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So somehow word got back to the king. So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men whom have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." So he knew that they were in town and that they were looking around and that they had already been conquering. And he was somewhat worried. So he had personal words with these with Rahab herself. Verse 4, then the woman took the two men and hid them. And she said, now she's still talking to the king, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut, when it was dark, that the men went out." Again, this is quoting Rahab. "Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them." Verse 6, but she, parentheses, she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. She just lied to the king, straight away to his face. She lied. She knew. She had them up there in the stalks of flax. They weren't out running away somewhere. Then the men pursued them by the road. So the men that the king sent went out, all of them went out on the road, thinking that they were chasing these two spies, to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. So before they lay down, she came up on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land. The terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water in the Red Sea, and for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, and whom you utterly destroyed." So she knew that God was working with this group of people by the things that had happened. Did you realize that Rahab was mentioned in the faith chapter? Probably a lot of you do. So let's go to the faith chapter. Let's go to the faith chapter, Hebrews 11. We're going to read verses 30 of Hebrews 11 to 32. By faith, verse 30, the walls of Jericho fell down, for they were encircled for 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe, when she had received the spies with peace. In verse 32, "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and also of David." So we see Rahab being mentioned, and conspicuously, a great man is not mentioned here. The same man that sacked her city, Joshua, wasn't here. But Rahab was. Rahab was mentioned, and he was a great man. Joshua led the people of God and was a very great man. But they mentioned Rahab here. So, getting back to Moses for a second. Did you know that his mom is mentioned here in the faith chapter? I mean, we're looking at all of these women that are mentioned in the faith chapter. So, since we're here, we're going to look at that. Verse 23. doesn't have her by name. We know her name. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, Amram and Jochebed, because they saw he was a beautiful child. And here we go. They were not afraid of the king's command. His parents. They were not afraid of the king's command. You can read about his parents, Numbers 26, verse 59. It gives a little bit more about them, Amram and Jochebed. Now, like Shiphrah and Puah, they feared God and not the king. Most likely, these parents knew the midwives. Very likely that they did, because they'd already had two children. They'd already had, right, Aaron and Miriam, they'd already had need of midwives by the time this third child was born. As it happens, the third child is mentioned here in the faith chapter, verse 27. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Here we go again. Not fearing the king. Not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Speaking of Moses. Let's look at James 2. Just a couple of pages towards the end here. James 2, we're going to read verses 23 to 26. Verse 23, and the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. And he was called the friend of God. You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way, meaning the pursuing party, the posse? For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead. So we see a clear point here is that these were works that led to life. They all did something. They did something. Why? Central thread here, they feared God. That's what motivated the actions of all of these people. So the harlot that feared God was mentioned in a very important bloodline. Let's go back to Matthew 1. Right here at the beginning of the New Testament. There's only five women mentioned by Matthew in Matthew's genealogy of Christ that are part of his bloodline. In verse 3, we read the first one, Tamar. Judah begat Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Verse 5, we see Rahab and we see Ruth in verse 5. And in verse 6, not by name, but we see Bathsheba mentioned. David the king begot Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. So that's 4, right? And then we have in verse 16, we have Mary. Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, whom was born Jesus, who was called Christ. So we see Rahab now in this bloodline through her actions that she did. So as long as we're looking at women, what did Rahab, Shiphrah, and Mary, and for that matter, Moses' mom, all have in common? They all feared God more than the king. The oldest book in the Bible describes what wisdom is, and as you know by now, it's the central theme of this message. Job 28, verse 28. This is also repeated. We're not going to go there. Almost word for word in Psalm 11, verse 10. So we're just going to look at Job because it's basically the same exact thing that David wrote years later. And to man he said, behold, what? The fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. So that fear of the Lord helped the midwives to make the correct decision. They had wisdom to make that decision that they made, and God, as we just read, rewarded them very much for us. So the midwives, Rahab, Moses' mom, Mother Mary of Jesus, all of them, all of these people we looked at today had to make real-world decisions, moral choices. They made the right ones because they feared God and not the king.